now. Detonate the reality bomb!
Alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
As China goes, so goes the world. Possibly. It is certainly perhaps a leading indicator of where things are headed, and we're going to talk about that during the course of this next hour or so. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest is a gentleman we've talked to before. He's got 30 years of international ministry and business experience, which gives him some insight into what we can glean from the numbers that are put out by the financial services and information agencies on a daily basis. He's the co-author with Doug Krieger and Doug Woodward of the book, The Final Babylon, America and the Coming of Antichrist. And if I don't edit this out, we'll just dive right in. It's our pleasure to welcome Dean McGriff back to the program. Dean, thanks for joining us today. And I apologize fumbling like a guy holding a greased football on the goal line, the introduction there. The times in which we're living are really interesting, but the information that's coming our way about international trade, about the status of bankers and the large international banks is not really comforting. We spoke last July when the Chinese stock markets began showing signs of weakness, began to really tank, but they got off to the worst start in the history of the Chinese exchanges at the beginning of 2016, as did the New York Stock Exchange. The price of oil is hovering at or just below $30 a barrel, which looks great when you're filling up your gas tank for under a buck and a half a gallon, but it has some implications for the economy. Not just those in oil field services or exploration or drilling, but the banks who made loans on properties, assuming that the price of oil would be $80 to $100 a barrel. What do you see coming, and how do we fit this into a biblical and specifically prophetic worldview?
Well, that's a great question, Derek. I always like to start out, you know, with the last chapter in Daniel 12. It says, conceal and conceal these things until the end, and then all these things will be revealed to you. And I think that there have been so many misconceptions about prophecy and so forth because the time hasn't been right. When the time is right and we have a need to know, I think we will know, and I think that this is unfolding even as we speak. When we look at the economy, you know, the one thing that stands out to me, and you mentioned in your email to me, is just credit. Credit and debt. And, you know, we almost are there in terms of being in a cashless society. We have about half of a trillion, about $500 billion in actual physical money circulating in the United States, mm-hmm. but we're running with about $60 trillion in debt. So, you know, we look at this and we say, you know, this is a house of cards and it's about ready to collapse. And it really is. It almost collapsed in 2008, but they so-called saved the banks that are too big to fail. I don't know that that'll happen once this happens again. And as you mentioned, China is really huge, the second largest economy in the world, but it's bound to fail. And the reason is they've got such a load of population, one and a third billion people, and they've got a planned economy, and we know planned economies are meant to be a disaster. Just ask the Russians how it turns out.
Yeah,
and it didn't turn out well for them. And China, we don't really realize it, but we talk about U.S. debt. China is the most debtor nation, the biggest debtor nation in the world, and we don't even realize that. They're 3.5 times their GDP in debt. And they've made absolutely terrible decisions in terms of what they're going to invest in and the things they're going to build. They built cities for a couple million people and nobody's living there. They built factories that are empty. They built neighborhoods that are empty. And so they're really squandering resources like crazy. And so, obviously, here they are looking really, really bad at the moment. Excuse me, I need to grab a glass of water here.
No, that's understandable. And by the way, we should point out that Dean has very graciously, because he's currently on the road, had to drive to a location where he could get a cell phone signal in order to talk with us today. So I appreciate that's more effort than most people want to make when they have to talk to me. So I really appreciate that.
You'll hear a little dune buggy or something like that go by every now and then. I'm basically on a not-too-traveled road. But
no, that's all right. We are on one of the main roads that leads to Table Rock Lake and one of the nice marinas on Table Rock Lake here in the Ozarks. And we've got 78-degree temperatures outside today. And I understand from the folks up at the bait and tackle shop where I get gas up on the corner that the fish are starting to bite. So I've seen at least 8 boats pull past our house since lunchtime. So we're seeing some.
Yeah, I'm down on Lake Havasu and it's 82 right now.
Okay.
We're having a little weather.
Yeah. Well, we might hear some noise in the background here, but it's all right. We don't mind.
Right. So at any rate, we're looking at China is beginning to implode, and we're really looking at this whole house of credit cards just about ready to tumble. And, you know, that is where the rub is. We're not going to be hyperinflating. What the infusion of credit has done really the whole world over throughout Europe, throughout Asia, the United States, is it's created bubbles. So when the bubbles burst, you have a deflation. You're going to have lowering of prices, of commodities. We've seen everything from oil to gold and silver and iron and steel and cotton and corn, and all of these commodities have been falling in the last year or so. And so the deflation is beginning. And what's happened is the banks doubled down after 2008. They doubled down on commodities. They saw this and they said, we can control this. We can, you know, ride oil up to $200 a barrel and we're going to make a killing. And instead, it's gone from 120 down to, as you said at the beginning, down to $30 a barrel. The thing is that they can hide this debt that's been leveraged again and again and again into derivatives. But eventually, just like the home that goes up to $500,000, but its real value is $200,000, eventually that has to be written off. And when it's written off, when, you know, the debt comes due, if you will, that's the point in time when these losses hit the banks and it's going to bring them down.
Now, you talk about the banks doubling down on commodities, and you made an interesting comment earlier that I'd like to go back and explain just a little bit, because it may not be apparent to all of us exactly what this means. You mentioned that the gap between the money in circulation, the actual dollars that are being traded back and forth, and the amount of debt that is outstanding. Why does it matter that the amount of debt out there is greater than the amount of money in circulation?
Well, there's absolutely no way to pay it off. You know, there isn't enough. Eventually, debts either are written off or they're paid off. And if they're written off, then somebody's going to lose their shirt because people have put that money out there. And, you know, we're working in what will ultimately destroy all currency, and we will become a cashless society. And, you know, where that can go, and we're almost there. I mean, we are almost to the point where you go to the bank and you try and withdraw I can't withdraw more than $400 a day.
Really?
Out of my bank. Yeah.
Huh.
That's what I'm limited to. And, you know, they want you to use credit. They're encouraging people to use credit. I pay 2.99% now on my credit card.
Really?
Yeah.
Great. Googly moogly. It sounds like there's a digit missing in there.
I mean, yeah, it really does. But it's going there where, you know, one of these days, if you can imagine, you know, this the whole credit scenario seizes up. You go to your ATM and you can't get money. You go to your bank and you can't get money. You go to use your credit card and it won't work. You know, they are not taking it any longer. You know, I think you know, that is eventually going to happen. And when it does, it's going to be a really sad day for people like, you know, us, and almost anybody is using credit for almost everything now. Use it for your gas, use it for your groceries, use it for this, that, the restaurant, the McDonald's, whatever. And that's, if that system stopped working, we would be in a big, big problem.
Yeah, in a world of hurt. I'm probably as guilty of this as anybody because I use my debit card for almost everything. Now, Sharon and I haven't really... I think we took out a Home Depot card a couple of years ago because we needed to repair the lower level after we got flooded in a torrential rain in Illinois. But we've not had a credit card for the sake of actual purchases other than that one card that we used to buy, you know, supplies since about 2006, actually. So for 10 years, we've been without actual credit cards, but we use our debit cards for almost everything. I find myself more often than I care to admit with no cash at all in my pocket. I've been seeing stories more and more lately, and I've been talking about this on Skywatch TV, of prominent bankers and economists arguing that we should eliminate cash, especially large denomination bills. The European Central Bank this past week, as we record this in late February of 2016, voted to eliminate the 500 euro banknote, which accounts for about 30% of the physical cash in circulation in the Eurozone. And now Bloomberg, the Washington Post, Lawrence Summers, the former Secretary of Treasury, just this past week in the Washington Post, wrote an op-ed piece arguing that we should eliminate the $100 bill, you know, ban the Benjamin.
Right.
But the $100 bill, and the argument that they're telling us is that this would be good for fighting crime because only people who are trying to avoid taxes or launder money to facilitate the illegal drug trade or terrorism or weapon sales are using cash anymore. So we need to eliminate the $100 bill. But in doing that, they would eliminate 78% of the physical money in circulation. Why do they want to do this?
It's control, control, control. You know, it used to be 10,000 was the flag for making a transfer out of your accounts. Now it's down to 3,000. You know, everything is reported.
Wow.
And they want to know that cash is going, and it's all a matter of control.
Well, what about negative interest rate policy? That's something else that I've been seeing a lot of. And now, forgive me for asking what are probably simple questions, but my BA or my BS, I think, in economics, and most of what I learned in economics was BS, is just bare bone minimum. I kind of lost interest after law of supply and demand and the Laffer curve, but this is something else that we're seeing more and more around the world. Japan, Switzerland, Sweden, Denmark all have central banks that have pushed their lending rate to the member banks in their systems into negative territory. They're actually paying the member banks to borrow money from the central bank. That seems crazy. What kind of a business model is this?
Well, it is, and I mean, it's absolutely a failed business model. First of all, they went down to 0% lending, and then they started doing the QE2, QE1, QE2, QE3, and in which they're just loaning money to banks, just please use it. And, of course, banks, rather than using it responsibly and loaning it to people, they doubled down on commodities and things like that. Even the real estate bubble starting to reinflate. But now the negative, if you want to know what the future is, it's really interesting. Look at Japan. Japan has done absolutely everything wrong. Their economy crashed in 89, over 25 years ago. They lost 3/4 of the value of all of their stocks and all of their real estate, and they have not recovered since. They've done everything wrong. They've done everything from public works to zero interest rates, and they were the ones that started the negative interest rates, which means pay us to keep your money safe, I guess. You know, they have these fees and so forth that, you know, for the privilege of letting them hold your money, they charge you now. And so now Europe is going there. Everybody is going there. And it's just because, you know, the role of central banks was presumably to control, economy and so forth, and they did that basically with interest rates making money either, you know, cheap or expensive. But nowadays, because we've inflated all of these asset prices, there's no way they can start to charge interest rates. So they just keep doubling down, hoping people will keep coming to them, coming to the trough and getting more money and creating more debt. And it's just the absolute worst thing they could possibly do in the long run, but it's the only thing they can do.
It's almost as though they're saying, well, this last round of stimulus didn't work, so let's apply even more, because clearly we just didn't do enough to get people out there spending money again. The thing that struck me I'm just amazed that these giant economic brains in these think tanks haven't come across this yet, but a guy who I respect a lot, Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who writes on the financial, he's the financial editor for The Telegraph in the UK, wrote an excellent book years ago about some of the conspiracies behind the Clinton administration during the Clinton presidency. And it was amazing that it was only the London reporters who saw what was going on here in Washington, D.C. But Evans Pritchard wrote that what's happened, instead of encouraging people to go out and spend more money, is that people who are saving for retirement and planning on a certain rate of return on their savings are finding now that savings rates are so low that they're essentially below. When you factor in inflation, they're back basically negative interest rates. People are either saving more money and stocking it away instead of spending it, or they're pulling it out of the banks and sticking it under a mattress because you get a better rate of return there.
You do. That's why the people that are really in the know, you know, that know really what's going on, they're telling people, they say, the First National Bank, your mattress, have about a third of your assets at home in cash, because we don't know how long the rest of the system based on credit is going to even exist.
Yeah.
One thing that's good about the, you know, everybody's saying the United States is in such bad shape, and actually since the 70s, Howard Ruff and all these people were predicting, you know, the end of our economy because of our debt and so forth. We've just kept going deeper and deeper in debt. But the thing is, we're a lot better off than most countries. We have tremendous national resources. We still have, you know, the basis for a fairly solid economy. So when we float bonds, people from all over the world always come to the United States, and they oversubscribe. You know, they'll have three or four buyers for every dollar that we're selling. And the reason that they're doing it is because at least we've paid off our debts. We have no history of default, and we're still looked as good as gold, at least on an international basis.
Huh.
And we know different, but the rest of the world looks at us, and we're still the best game in town. I mean, name another country that's halfway solvent and in decent condition.
Yeah.
There really isn't any.
Well, yeah, until recently, I would have said, by recently, I mean the last few years, it seemed that Russia, sure. It seemed that Russia was on its way toward solvency through its use of petroleum resources as a geopolitical right. tool, but the drop in the price of oil over the last couple of years has really put the kibosh on that. Now, of course, that's also put the hurt on American producers, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit. But I would have said either Russia or perhaps China. But one of the consequences of what's happened on the Chinese markets is that a lot of people, they drew the common person into the market to invest, just like average Americans were drawn into the market back in the 90s when we were running just all of those ads during the Super Bowl. Everybody can be a day trader in their spare time and make lots and lots and lots of money. The Chinese fell for the same thing, and then suddenly the market fell off the cliff. And now they've got people who had put life savings, farmers and grandmothers, into the stock market, and they've been wiped out.
Or even buy houses. They'd buy three or four houses, and they're empty. They have no cash flow. They're losing them.
Yeah. So you're right. The United States, for all of our issues here, we're probably in better shape than anyone else out there. Circling back to China, and the thing that's going on there, last year, the first half of the year, there were some stories that came out about the yuan, or the renminbi, as it's officially known, I guess, the Chinese currency being accepted by the International Monetary Fund as another currency in its basket of special drawing rights. In other words, another step closer to Chinese, the Chinese currency becoming the reserve currency. And I know that there are still some prophecy teachers out there saying that this is going to dethrone the U.S. dollar as the official reserve currency. But the yuan has also fallen off the cliff at the same time as their stock market. I'm wondering, is there any indication that what's going on with the Chinese economy is being manipulated behind the scenes by Westerners who don't want the Chinese stepping up to the same level?
I have no idea about conspiracies, but they don't really need much help because, you know, they're under such a tremendous load. They've invested so unwisely, just arbitrarily in this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, so they're just falling under their own weight, that tremendous, huge population. And their air is terrible. Their water is terrible. It's polluted and so forth. And they have so many problems just holding it together with a billion plus people. You know, the idea that the yuan can replace the dollar is kind of laughable. Really hard to replace the dollar as the basic world currency. You know, it all started in 72, as you know, and it was basically all oil will be bought and sold. It was a deal we cut with the king of Saudi Arabia and so forth. And so the United States was willing to be at risk. And if you look at, you know, we have $1.5 trillion in the world, about $500 billion in the United States. The other trillion are sitting out there in central banks and in banks around the world, and they're using it to trade. We had to make ourselves vulnerable to do that, but that's how we became the currency that the world trades in. Well, the yuan isn't international. They keep devaluing their currency, and nobody wants to really trade in it because you can't even count on the value, and they keep lowering the value so that their goods are reasonable, and so it's just not a good central currency. And so, you know, the other thing is when we come back to prophecy, we come back to, you know, our book. I don't want to say much about it, but I mean, you know, there is a great end times nation that's a consumer nation of the world, that's an economic powerhouse, it's a military powerhouse, that's apostate Christian, and it's a friend of Israel because it signed a treaty with Israel. And I can only think of one, you know, right offhand, you know, that fills that. And China certainly doesn't, although there may be as many real Christians in China if you follow what's been going on there with the underground church.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they may soon need to be.
It's very, very confusing, and everything is a little bit counterintuitive.
Yeah, they may need to be sending evangelists and missionaries over here, to get us back on track. The situation in the Middle East, the geopolitical situation there, of course, is troubling. And anytime you get violence and warfare taking place in the neighborhood of Israel, it deserves our study. Not that we should read prophecy into every single headline, but it certainly is interesting and significant, I think, that we're seeing the apocalyptic vision of radical Islam coming to the fore in terms of what drives change in the Middle East. I'm talking about the Islamic State, of course. You know, contrary to what Western politicians believe, it's pretty easy to see what they're about because they put it out there in their magazine every single month.
Exactly.
You know, and somehow the politicians in Europe and North America still are trying to find clues as to what motivates the Islamic State in their branding strategy or their use of social media. But at behind all of that, and maybe even a more significant driver of what will ultimately play out in the Middle East is the Sunni-Shia conflict. What do you see happening between Iran and Saudi Arabia and their proxies?
That is true. That is absolutely, you know, Israel, of course, is the poor canary in the coal mine, and all of this is going on around them. And there's just no doubt about it that the proxy war is already going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And the Shia-Sunni conflict, and then they're already, you know, in Yemen, and they're the Saudis are trying to strike back. The real problem is, and I've been over to Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and that part of the world, and missed Israel, darn it, but still have to get there one of these days. But at any rate, I have been to that part of the world, and it's really, really, really interesting. You know, very, the thing I worry about more than anything is that now that the sanctions have been lifted on Iran, there's nothing stopping Iran now from taking the $100 billion or so that they got from us and causing a whole lot of trouble with that and really rearming, and Russia's being glad to help and so forth. If they ever decided to attack Saudi Arabia, I mean, if you've ever been there, that the Saudis don't work, you know, they have Filipinos and Indians and Pakistanis and others coming in to do all the work. I mean, they really are just a very soft people. I don't think that they're ever, you know, most of them are not willing to die for their country because they just don't have that kind of a fanatical connection to it that the Iranians do. Mm-hmm. So what I see is very possible to happen is that one of these days, I think Iran's first target is not going to be Israel. I think that's just for publicity's sake and to keep the eye off of what they're really doing. But they're really looking at Saudi Arabia, and they want it, Mecca, Medina, and they want that area, and they want to get rid of the Sunnis. So to me, that's the big danger in the Middle East. And the day that those oil wells in the whole Emirates and there in the Gulf and in Saudi go up in smoke is the day that within the next couple, 3 years, I see oil going back up to $200 or $300 a barrel. Hmm. You know, because Iran is going to take on those countries, and that war is going to not be it's going to just blow up in everybody's face, and we're going to be sitting there really surprised.
That, and I know this is not the intended consequence of that action, but that actually might be the shot in the arm that the American shale oil industry needs to get back on its feet. It's reeling like a drunkard now, to borrow a phrase from Scripture. Oh, yeah. I learned a little bit about the oil industry when I spent the last 4 years, well, I guess, you know, not counting last year, for the last 5 years, working in steel sales in southern Illinois. I hadn't realized how important oil was to the economy south of Interstate 70 in the state of Illinois. Those are some of the oldest oil fields in the country, which is why, to my surprise, there's a Marathon refinery in Robinson, Illinois, which is near Terre Haute, that dates back to the 1920s. Oh. That was the center of the American oil industry 100 years ago. But apparently, the geography under the state of Illinois, or the geology, rather, is very similar to western North Dakota. And there are some estimates that between the Bakken Formation and the New Albany Formation in southern Illinois, we could have like 5 or 6 times the amount of oil as Saudi Arabia, except that it's not profitable until you get above $80 a barrel.
It's been incredibly successful, even in Texas, where these oil fields were just like those in
right.
Pennsylvania, all over. You know, they were played out, and now it turns out there's 3 or 4 times as much as they ever took out available with new technology. So there are some real game changers in there that make the United States really the biggest oil producing nation in the world.
Yeah.
Not to mention our natural gas, which is incredible.
Yeah.
We're sitting on the catbird seat in that respect.
But unfortunately,
if we had an administration that would help.
that's one of the consequences. That's the other thing I found out. There's nobody south of Interstate 70 who's connected to coal, which is the other big player there, or oil, or the agriculture industry, really. Who, in fact, the joke was that they should have posted big signs at Indiana and Missouri saying, "Welcome to Illinois. Sorry about the Obama thing." But still, the price of oil, at least in the short run, because it's driven more by speculators than it is by actual supply and demand, would drive the price up, and that would cause an economic shock. It would lead to hardship, at least in the short term. And I think you're right about. I also think you're right.
Don't you think?
Go ahead.
Don't you think though that they have the ability to to produce it once the initial investment's made. I think they can do it for about 45, even 50 a barrel.
Well, that's true. Drilling for new wells, the guys that I talk to like to see it at above $80 in Illinois. And it's not quite that high in Texas, from what I've read. And there are quite a few wells that have been drilled and were active in North Dakota that have been taken offline that could go back online fairly quickly. So, yeah, I think once the initial shock of the higher oil price was absorbed, I think, yes, the beneficiary would be the American oil industry, and ultimately it would be self-defeating for the Iranians and the Saudis or any of the Middle Eastern oil-producing nations to try to drive the price of oil up, because the response would be, okay, we'll just turn our turn our wells back on and we'll start producing it here again. But, you know, back to the geopolitical goals of Iran, though, I do agree that Iran is more of an existential threat to Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the UAE than it is to Israel. And I think the same holds true for the Islamic State, and for the same reason. They want the credibility of being in control of the holy sites of Medina and Mecca. And Jerusalem would come later.
I agree, yeah. You and I are on the same page on that one. Absolutely.
But it still means that the whole area there becomes a real dangerous neighborhood. And then the question is, looking at what specifically is happening right now in Syria, where Turkey has been rattling its saber and trying to drum up support from what I've read. You don't see it so much in the English press, the American press, but in some of the Arabic language, the English versions of the Arabic language newspapers. I tend to watch them just to see what they're reporting. And they have been reporting for a couple of weeks now that Turkey's been trying to drum up support with its NATO allies, which of course includes the United States and most of Western Europe, for a ground invasion of Syria. Now, we have to remember that Russia has soldiers and pilots on the ground in Syria. So the implication there, I mean, what is Russia's end game? What is Russia trying to get out of its geopolitical maneuvering? What do you think Putin wants?
Well, it looks to me like Putin really wants to dominate Europe. You know, they're providing all the oil and gas that goes into Europe, and you throw Iran and Russia together. They've already built this pipeline in record time that went all the way to China. So they really have China under their control, as well as Europe. Talk about a geopolitical move. Russia, now then you have Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is, of course, just playing this gigantic card that they've played many times historically, but this gigantic card, which is, let's drive the price of oil down to $10 a barrel if we have to, because we've got to nip Iran and Russia in the bud and bankrupt them if we can and get them off the map. And I think that's what they're really trying to do right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they're, I really don't see them succeeding, but they're sure trying.
It is, it's almost like watching the fulfillment of the prophecy, the hook in the jaws. And I'm not saying that Magog is on the verge of being pulled into the Ezekiel 38 war, but I'm beginning to understand the concept. I think we're seeing nations do things that to me seem absolutely insane. And yet the rulers of those nations seem to feel that they have no choice.
Well, you look and there's on that side of the equation, there's Turkey, Iran, and Russia, and they're all really working together very well at the moment.
Yeah, it is, again, hard to see what the end game or how this is all going to play out. I mean, the Turks, knowing that Russia is across the border, is still continuing to shell positions of rebels that have been backed. Well, they've been backed by the United States. It's hard to tell the players without a scorecard there, because you've got the United States, for example, backing Iranian militia in Syria against the Islamic State, and yet being shot at by Iranian militia in Iraq, where or Iranian backed militia, Shiite militia in Iraq. it just doesn't. I think the head of the STRATFOR, which is an intelligence service that you can subscribe to.
Yeah,
and we subscribe to it as well. It's a good resource. The head of Stratfor wrote about 6 months ago, and I thought he was being kind, that the Obama administration's policy in the region, Syria and Iraq, was incoherent.
Well, it was incoherent, but, you know, I'm going to say something, this is tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, Obama was probably the most successful president we've ever had. Now let me explain what I mean by that.
Okay.
I mean, he was, you know, and if you look at the pictures of him when he was young, when he was in confirmation in Kenya, in a Muslim mosque, you know, he definitely was Shia. I mean, he was sitting there with his red robe and his white turban, which is, you know, the Shia, I mean, the Sunni, no, the Shia. The Shias wear the white turbans and Sunni wear the black, you know, thing, rim around it.
Hmm.
And, you know, he everything he has done has been to help Iran and to help the Shia in Iraq. He's done everything that he can. So he's, you know, done everything he can to diminish the U.S. economy, diminish our role in the world, diminish our reputation in the world, diminish everything. And, you know, if that was his goal, he's been really successful because he's completed that.
Hmm. Well, that would seem to have more explanatory power than believing that he was actually trying to take out the Islamic State. Russia has been kind of tongue-in-cheek in some of the comments that they've made about our policy there. It's like, well, maybe they're not trying. Maybe the U.S. Air Force isn't trying very hard. And I must say that I don't believe that the success that the Russians have had with their airstrikes against the Islamic State and other rebels, because they've been able to do in less than 5 months what we couldn't do in a year and a half. And I don't believe I don't believe it's because Russia has better pilots or better equipment or better intelligence than the United States.
It's just that we didn't want to hurt the poor drivers of the trucks.
Yes.
You know, or have their collateral damage, right. And they just happen to put their bases and their missiles and so forth in the schools and in the mosques and so forth. And we do 20 sorties a day instead of 2,000. And, you know, it's been crazy. It's been just a token.
Dropping leaflets warning the truck drivers, airstrike is coming, leave your truck and run away. It is astonishing.
Exactly.
Well, there has to be some encouraging news out of all of this. I mean, basically, people have listened to us for the last half hour or thereabouts have heard the economy is on the brink of disaster. China is about bankrupt. Russia is getting desperate. Iran wants to start a war. Basically, the world is going in a handbasket. What as Christians can we look to as or maybe it's a two-part question. Good advice on how to prepare for one. And secondly, what do we look to in the scriptures for comfort, knowing that this too shall pass?
That's a great question. I mean, my Doug Krieger and I, we both see eye to eye with this, and that is that, you know, the church is, this is our finest hour coming up. You know, I believe that, you know, the Lord, that God has his witnesses on the earth. You can't have a conviction. You can't convict the world of sin and rebellion unless you have two witnesses. You know, you can't convict anybody of a crime biblically unless you have two witnesses. And he's got his physical people, stiff-necked though they may be, but the Jews are still there. And I've love to witness the Jews because, you know, I just say, hey, you're still here 2,000 years later. How come? None of the Hittites or Amorites or Amalekites or the otherites, they're all gone, but you're still here. Yeah, I know. You know, they sort of say, I wish, like Fiddler on the Roof, I wish you weren't a chosen people, because why do you choose us all the time?
Yeah.
then we have the church, and the church is always at its finest hour in the midst of persecution. And, oh my goodness, it's heartbreaking to see the number of people around the world and in Africa, the number of Christians that are just being destroyed en masse, you know, and so we're being also divided as a nation between, as we see in election periods, you know, and you know, it's just not, it's coming up to the point in time where there are going to be those Christians that are going to stand up and be counter to those that are just going to say, hey, I give up, I'm going to blend into the culture and, you know, just, you know, go to the soccer games and do what I have to do and let whatever happens happen, and maybe I'll rapture out of here and heck with it, you know.
Yeah.
I think this is the worst. The finest hour of the church is when we can stand up and testify and stand in the world and say, hey, no, this isn't right, and this isn't where it's going. You know, our Lord has overcome, and he will overcome in us, and we're going to go through a time when it is going to, the church is going to shine again, and it's going to be coming from all over. I mean, the one thing I like about the letter to the seven churches is that there's overcomers in each one of them, no matter how bad they are.
Hmm.
And I believe that that's the case. There are overcomers out there, and whoever is willing to pay that price, and the toward testimony and revelation is martyria, you know, so it's those who are overcome by the word of the testimony and the blood of the Lamb, and they love not their lives unto death. And pretty old definition, but I think it's still going to be accurate. And it's going to be accurate again. The more accepted we are by society, the worse we become.
Yeah, as Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, woe unto you when the world speaks well of you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, Dean, where do people follow?
I think it's exciting. I wouldn't want to be alive any other time than right now. I mean, I feel an honor and a privilege to, no matter what happens, well, again.
That's a good way of looking at it. Again, it's when you step back and look at it, knowing that God knew the end from the beginning and selected those of us who are here to be here at this specific point in history. It
yeah.
gives you a little more sense of the gravity of the task at hand, but also the ultimate reward. Dean McGriff, author and speaker. Dean, where do people follow your work on the web?
Well, I kind of have my website is down at the moment. I'm having my webmaster's kind of redoing it. We had to do a redo of it because after 25 years, it's a little out of date and so forth. So there really isn't anything now. Most of what I've done is Google my name, and you'll find all the articles on Google.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like a good place to start. I'll put a link there in the show notes. Dean, pleasure talking with you again. And as you're traveling around the country looking for a spot, you know, make sure to stop by the Ozarks and check us out.
Amen. Sure will. Sure will, Derek.
Check the show notes at vftb.net, and again, I'll put a link there to direct you to where you can find the writings of Dean McGriff, again, the co-author of the book The Final Babylon, with Doug Krieger and Doug Woodward, a point of view that not everyone will agree with. I think all of us who live in America can see spiritually we appear to be Babylon, but is it the final Babylon of prophecy? That remains to be seen. Well, once again, I find myself in the position of having to apologize for being so late to getting this program to the internet. I am finding that the schedule that we're keeping between Skywatch TV, our weekly Bible study, and a writing project or two that I am trying to get motivated to get really underway is just, it's difficult to keep up the twice a week schedule I had hoped to maintain. On A View from the Bunker. So we're going to go back to a once-a-week schedule, which was the original intent of this program. Moved it to twice a week because there are a lot of people out there that I want to talk to who have important things to say. But schedule-wise, it just really isn't practical. Just too many other things, demands on the time going in the day. And maybe it's a way, you know, for the Lord to say, you know, you need to take a few hours in the evening to just decompress or write or do something other than sit in front of a microphone. If our office here in the new ridgetop bunker in the heart of the Ozarks weren't directly off the master bedroom, I would probably be spending a lot of evenings doing exactly that. But because Sharon heads to bed a little early, it's a way for her to keep a schedule that keeps her feeling well with the fibromyalgia. I really can't do that anymore. So, you know, that my evenings are no longer spent in front of a microphone. But since I'm spending almost all day in front of a microphone between Skywatch and other things that I'm doing at the office there, it's probably healthier anyway. So, if you want to keep up with everything that I'm doing, we've got stuff scattered across a number of websites, and maybe there's a better way ultimately that we'll figure out to put it all in one place to make it easier to find. But I've been posting all of these interviews, or links to them, I should say, along with most everything we do at Skywatch TV, to my personal website, which is derekpgilbert.com. That's D-E-R-E-K-P-Gilbert.com.
www.thefreedomfighters.com. And that's one easy way to just sort of follow everything in one place. We've got a website that we really haven't used much, and we may decide to just make that sort of the hub for everything that Sharon and I do. Her website, PID Radio, View from the Bunker, my website, and of course the Gilbert House Fellowship, the Bible study that we have been producing every week, and maybe just to put everything there, but we'll let you know about that. Other things going on. So, like I said, just trying to keep up with it in a way that keeps life in its proper balance. So, speaking of the, well, life in general in balance, or the world in balance, the Middle East still seems teetering on the brink of all-out war. As I record this on February the 24th of 2016, the battle for Aleppo, which is the largest city in Syria, continues. Government forces, forces loyal to Bashar al-Assad, backed by Iranian troops, Iranian Republican Guard, and Hezbollah fighters, have been making gains in the countryside around Aleppo for some weeks now, and they're being heavily supported by Russian airstrikes. Well, the Islamic State cut the only road into Aleppo to support government forces. It was their supply line. This was a road that headed to the southeast, which had been controlled by government troops. ISIS cut that supply line on Monday of this week. And as far as I know, at this point on Wednesday, they, government troops, that is, have not yet reopened that supply line. So this may slow things down a bit. Kurdish forces pinned down near the city of Azaz, which is about 4 miles from the Turkish border, and they're taking a pounding from Turkish artillery. The Turks don't want the Kurds setting up an independent Kurdistan on their southern border. They consider the YPG, which are the Syrian Kurds, a terror organization. The United States considers the YPG a critical ally in the fight against the Islamic State. Now, the area that the Turks are shelling is an area in which Russian and Iranian troops are either operating now or will be operating soon, which means that it could be very short time before Iranians or Russians are coming under direct fire from Turkey. The Turks and Saudi Arabia have been threatening a ground invasion of northern Syria. Saudi Arabia has also moved air assets to the big Incirlik air base in southeastern Turkey, from which to launch strikes against the Islamic State. So things are getting more and more complex and more dangerous. The German newspaper Der Spiegel reported last Friday that German lawmakers are really concerned about this because Western Europe is essentially NATO. Western Europe plus the United States and Canada comprise the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, of which Turkey is a member. And under Article 5 of the NATO Charter, if Turkey goes to war with Russia, which is a possibility. I mean, Russia really hasn't retaliated for the Turkish Air Force shooting down that Su-24 fighter bomber back in November. If that turns into a shooting match under Article 5, the NATO allies of Turkey would be bound by treaty to join in on the Turkish side. The Germans are not happy about this and have warned Turkey through official NATO channels that if they start a war with Russia, NATO's not coming to Turkey's aid. Meanwhile, a report this week indicates that Russia has signed a long-term defense agreement with Armenia. Armenia, which historically has been the fulcrum of battles, wars between empires going back 2,000 years and more. Armenia was the prize in many of the wars fought between Rome and the Parthian Empire. And once again, it finds itself the fulcrum between East and West, Russia on the one hand and the United States and its Western allies on the other. Armenia shares about a 120-mile border with Turkey, and Russia has apparently been positioning troops on the Armenian border with Turkey. So, you know, it's geopolitical chessboard, and if we look at the human players and we just step back and scratch our heads and saying, why are these people doing this? Because this could blow up into a conflict of insane proportions that has nothing to do with the average American, the average German, the average Brit, the average Russian. We get nothing out of this. So we have to look at this through a biblical lens, which, of course, is that It's the principalities, the powers, the thrones, dominions, spiritual rulers of this present darkness who are using their human agents, their dupes, their useful idiots, to carry out various stratagems on the global chessboard. Because there's nothing else that makes any rational sense. So we'll just keep an eye on that situation because that could really blow up into something nasty. The Islamic State also reportedly moving a number of fighters out of harm's way because they have been taking a brutal pounding from the Russian Air Force since September. And some of their guys are now turning up in Libya, rather, which is another consequence of the Obama foreign policy, which, to my eyes, is like the foreign policy of a college sophomore who's drunk and playing a game of double board risk. It's ridiculous. It's in fact, this was the American response to try to figure out what's going on with the Islamic State and how to counter the Islamic State. John Kerry, Secretary of State John Kerry, went to Hollywood last week and had a secret meeting with movie studio executives. Warner Brothers, DreamWorks Animation, Sony Pictures, a number of other studios represented at this meeting. And John Kerry, apparently so tone deaf, politically tone deaf, that he had no shame about tweeting, "Hey, great convo with movie execs about how to counter the messaging of Daesh," which is the Arabic term for the Islamic State. Talking to movie studio executives about how to counter the messaging of the Islamic State. That is American foreign policy. They might talk to somebody like, Dr. Timothy Furnish or any number of other scholars of Islamic history who might be able to draw upon 1,400 years of religious violence and the long history of decapitations and other acts of holy war to draw some useful conclusions about what motivates the Islamic State. But instead, Western political leaders like John Kerry, Barack Obama, spokesmen for other Western governments, dismiss all of that and say, no, it must be something to do with their branding, their marketing, their use of social media. That must be it. If only we had a jobs program based in Raqqa or Aleppo or Ramadi. If this were parody, this was something like right out of The Onion, but it was on John Kerry's official Twitter feed. Picture of John Kerry surrounded by movie studio executives discussing how to counter the messaging of the Islamic State. Turning to guys whose only experience is defeating imaginary villains on a screen for advice on how to counter the most dangerous and frankly demonically inspired group of men on the planet. America, we get the government we deserve. Our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, posted twice on Sunday, except for this coming Sunday. Sharon and I will be out of town for the rest of this week, as she and Tom Horn will be a guest on Sid Roth Live. It's Supernatural Live tomorrow, February 25th. And so because of travel, we will take this Sunday off, and we will rejoin you on March the 6th, the first Sunday in March. But New Testament study and Old Testament study, and we've got them split up. If you look in the top menu bar at gilberthouse.org, you can follow both of those studies from the beginning. Next week on Skywatch TV, airing multiple times a week now, by the way. Skywatch TV has added two networks to the broadcast lineup. In addition to the Christian Television Network, there's the Victory Television Network, which covers most of Arkansas and the Memphis metropolitan area, and the Cornerstone Network, which broadcasts coast to coast over the air and on cable systems from headquarters in Pittsburgh. So the broadcast schedule, and I don't have it in front of me, so I'm going to try to do this from memory. Mondays at 8:30 p.m. on the Victory Television Network, Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. on the Victory Network, and 8:30 p.m. on the Christian Television Network. And all these times, by the way, are Central Time, which is UTC-6. Wednesday afternoons on the Cornerstone Network, 3:30 p.m., and then twice on Saturday, the Victory Television Network, 3:30 p.m. Saturdays, and the Christian Television Network, 7:30 p.m. Saturdays. You can find all of those times listed at skywatchtv.com at the top menu bar. There's a link that says channel listings. Click on that, and you'll get the complete and accurate listing of when and where to watch Skywatch TV. Next week, Timothy Alberino joins us to talk about his documentary series, True Legends. And that program will air all week on the various networks and, of course, be available as of Monday morning. Monday being, what, March 1st? Yes, March 1st. On the Skywatch TV channel on Roku. So give us a review on iTunes, if you don't mind. We sure appreciate that. And Stitcher as well. We appreciate you listening wherever you find us and download us into your ear holes. And remember, A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. Next week, we talk to Charles Pascal. That program uploaded March 6th. We're going to go to a Sunday broadcast schedule again. Charles Pascal about guardianship. Legal guardianship, court-appointed guardianship, and how America's seniors are being victimized. It's a powerful, important program if you're like me and you have a parent who is a senior. Be sure you're listening for that. Until then, remember, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.